I'm Richard. I'm in London and I'm as headless as they come and enjoying being spaced with this experience. We don't have an agenda and we're here as friends. Everybody I know, not everybody knows each other, by the way. And we are here just to share our experience of living the headless way. We don't know anything more about it than you, but we are very happy to share our response to this wonderful openness where we are. And so that's why I'm here. And it's marvelous to have friends that to share this with. It's just infectious, inspiring, fun. And we haven't, all of us haven't, some of us haven't done this before. I've just done it once before. So, okay, Jose and Lorraine, would you like just to say something?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Hello, my name is Lorraine. I live in Paris. And I know this way for 24 years. I was 20 when I met Douglas. And I share this practice with Jose at home, and we do workshop in summer in France. And I'm also a teacher for children. I don't speak very well English. I hope Jose will help me to say what I have to say. okay, so.
Yes, so I'm Jose, we are in Paris. My job is to teach philosophy. I met Douglas Harding in 93 when he came in Paris for a workshop. I discovered the space here 1 year before in reading a book of Nisargadatta Maharaj. Book is I Am That. Maybe you know the book, it's a masterpiece. So I discovered the space thanks to Nisargadatta Maharaj. But 1 year after, I met Douglas, and it was so important to attend to one of his workshops first and to see his marvelous experiment. Because thanks to this experiment, I was able to maybe integrate the seeing in my life, and I was able to share it with friends. So I've been sharing headlessness now for 25 years. We receive people here twice a month, and I do workshop in France, in Belgium, in Switzerland. So but we are very happy to be here with you. Thank you. Very nice.
Yes.
Very nice.
Marvelous. Well, since we've just done one couple, Karen and Amarnata, would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Karen. I'm from Holland. I'm doing the Headless Way about 10 years, I think. Discovered by grace, and well, it's the center of my life. It's lovely, yeah.
So my name's Amarnato. I'm English. I live in the Netherlands, and I come across the Headless Way when I was a Buddhist monk, and met Douglas and his wife Catherine about 20 years ago. Yeah, and. It's been an important part of my life ever since. It's very nice to meet you all.
Wonderful. And now Amir and Jade.
So I'm Amir. I was introduced to Headless Way stuff through doing a course called the Finders Course, which featured Richard, and found it very profound straight away, and then discovered the various online meetups, and there's the kind of retreat that Judy organizes, and have also been organizing some courses and workshops with Richard for different communities that I'm involved with. So yeah, it's played a part in my life for the last couple of years now.
Hi, I'm Jade. I have been headless for like 6 months now, introduced by Amir, and I've done a few of Richard's courses as well. So yeah, but I'm also based in London.
Thank you. And why not Jade and Christine?
Hi, I'm Christine, and I live in Maui. I've really, really benefited from the Headless Way. It's been an integral part of my life for several years, I think since 2004 or so, I'm guessing. And my daughter Jade is here. So we've got two Jades. So she can introduce herself.
Yeah, hi, I'm Jade. I'm from Maui as well. My mom took me to one of the workshops over the summer in Oregon, and we learned a lot about the headless ways. So I've been sort of involved for about 4 years now.
Thank you. And let's see, Becky.
Hi, I'm Becky. I'm in New York City. And I've been living, I started the Headless Way about a year ago in a course, like a mirror. And I've been going to the meetups, and headless feels normal now. Feels really good. It feels normal. Yeah, I'm so glad to be here sharing it with you. Welcome.
Thank you. Sequoia?
Yes, my name is Sequoia. I live on the Oregon coast in the United States, and have been aware of my true nature now for probably, 10, 11 years. And have attended meetings regularly with Richard, and now organize the American Gathering every year in here in the US, usually in Oregon on the coast. So headlessness has shifted the entire experience of how the world shows up. So it's the most precious thing. Thanks.
Wonderful, thank you. Judy?
Hello, everyone. It's really great to see all these people from everywhere, all around the world. I first met Douglas a very long time ago, about the same time as Richard. And I kept in touch, visited his place a lot. It changed my life, seeing who I really am. So I've had periods of time when I thought I could never keep it up, but here I am still doing it. And what I do is I do organize the Salisbury summer gathering, Salisbury in England. I'm in Swansea in South Wales, and we have this super get together every year. It's been going on for 25 years, and yeah, everybody is invited to come, but perhaps not this year because it might be cancelled. Anyway, it's good to meet everyone.
Thank you, Judy. Hank?
Hi, I'm Hank. I'm in Portland, Oregon. Been living the Headless Way for a number of years. It's good to be here with friends.
And John?
I live near Oxford in England, and I was given Douglas's On Having No Head book for my 21st birthday, okay? And that was brilliant. And I run workshops, online workshops on a Monday on the Zoom platform. Thank you.
Great. So Amir and Jade, any questions that jump out at you there?
Yeah, we'll start with a topical one from Vikas. Apologies anyone if I pronounce your name incorrectly. I'd like to ask how seeing helps you in these days of massive anxiety and fear all over the world because of coronavirus. Thank you, Vikas from Slovenia.
Yes, I thought that question would come up. Anyone got a response coming up? I'm just going to...
Yeah, I do. The answer to how this helps is one that I couldn't answer. I just know that it does. That in the past, fear in situations like this, fear and anxiety would very much be forefront. And up and until this point in this worldwide challenge, there has been no fear, no anxiety, no stress over this at all. And so I know headlessness is the contributing factor to that.
Thank you. Someone else? Yes, Christine.
So this is really a question that's near and dear to my heart. And it also might be helpful in answering the headache question. So I'm going to answer both the headache question and the question with regard to the coronavirus and the fear and anxiety that's happening in our society. So recently, in October, I was diagnosed with cancer. And I found out that I had breast cancer through a routine mammogram that I just went to the doctor and she said, oh, it's time for your mammogram. And I ended up finding out that I had breast cancer and then found out that I had to have both breasts removed and just went through basically hell, if you can imagine, because I was always healthy. I've always been healthy and I just kept questioning, well, did I bring this on some way? Why is this happening to me? It was awful. And I can really relate to pain and suffering happening, you know, in this body. But at the same time, the headless way helps me to place it. So even though it feels like it's happening and it's almost like a veil that covers over your outlook and perception because all you feel is pain. All you can feel is suffering. And until you can step back and be upstream of that and hold that suffering and hold that anxiety and pain and even this the cancer itself, I realized that the less I resisted, the more I could just kind of be with it and embrace it and love it without pushing it away so much. Because when I was pushing it away and resisting and trying to figure out answers, I would suffer more. And then being upstream of it, just kind of like, okay, I'm holding it in this space and it's almost like wings, like these wings of awareness were just holding me. And I knew that I would ultimately be okay. Even though my body wasn't okay, I was ultimately always, always okay and fine. And I've lost my breasts. I no longer have anything. So I don't know. I'm just going to show you. I have completely flat. And sorry to traumatize you if it upsets you to see that, but that's my reality. And I realize now that I'm not my body. I'm not my thoughts. I'm not my feelings. I am just a container for those. And looking back, I'm built open for all of it. And I don't have to know the why, and I don't have to know the answers. And why is this happening is just a recipe for suffering because I've gone there over and over again. And it just is. And it's part of like that whole Byron Katie thing of loving what is. So.
Thank you. John, did you want to say something?
It's a kind of matter of scale from my point of view. The scale of this space here, you know, as these hands disappear into it, is so vast, so vast. It's always there, okay? And whatever happens, you know, whether it be a panic or the virus, pain, whatever happens, it arises in this space, but it's a matter of scale. This space is vast and always there, and whatever arises will fall back into that. And as you say, Christine, identifying with that openness, with that capacity, is what does it. And you know, in that sense, we're kind of invulnerable. We meaning each of us from here. Yeah, that's my take.
I'll say something then that one of my reflections is that knowing what is happening is really difficult to know what is going on with the virus and what to do. You know, I follow the advice I'm given. I feel anxiety and fear or for my loved ones, you know. At the same time, wonderfully, I am aware of this space that we're celebrating here, which is real, which I do know. I don't know it, I don't understand it, but it's accessible. I can't see my head. Instead, I'm looking at this open space, and this is reliable and real and safe and true. In the you know, and it goes along with this. What I'm not quite sure what's going on, and I'm not in control of. But to have this safety within one's life, which it doesn't mean I'm now, you know, personally not feeling anxious. I, in the midst of this kind of storm that's going on, is this stillness at the center that is just so wonderful. And a bit like Sequoia, I don't understand it. I don't have to understand it, but I am it. And I remember Douglas Harding once saying, see this when it's easy, but if you can manage to see it when times are difficult, that will impress itself on you even more in a way. Well, for me, these are difficult times. So my challenge is to see, to have all this within me and right, you know, this is a situation. Now let me see who I am through this situation. Yeah.
Most of you sound as if you've have made a permanent shift into headlessness. Has anyone experienced a back and forth before fully settling into it? Thanks from Asma from the UK.
Wonderful question. Now, who, Judy. Judy and then Karen.
Oh, well, settled into it. Yes, I do, most of the time, but absolutely back and forth for years. It's something that kind of grows on one, I find, and sometimes I have assiduously practiced and done all sorts of things to try and make myself remember to look here. And other times it's just happened because of life circumstances. I can't say much about the virus in the last question, but I can say something about everyday challenge with the person I live with, because we had an example of that today where we got into an argument and I got carried away into the blame game. We both did. And so I was definitely not seeing. And then we sat down and I said, this is terrible. And I made a determined effort to come back here and clear all that stuff and just listen. And what I found was that I got to know my friend in such a deep way that I never had before. We have actually been living together for more than 10 years. But I don't think had the quality of listening and my recognition of the other person there was so much deeper. And that was solely because I put my stuff to one side. It wasn't getting me anywhere to be in my stuff. What was getting me somewhere was to be clear and receptive. And what I do find is that living the headless way means that whatever comes up can be a challenge, but it's also a lesson. It also deepens my understanding of people, myself, of life, of what it's like to be here now. And it was a very dramatic example of going from being in my little self to being just the open self, the big one, as we say in the card. All the words, different words that we use, being who I really am rather than who I think I am or feel I am or remember that I am or even would like to be.
Thank you, Judy. Karen?
Yes. I think for my experience that, you know, to reach some permanent state or permanent, well, yes, state, I think is the best word, was one of my fantasies that would happen, like, you know, preferably a very positive one, like a peaceful one and, you know, a blissful one and all of that. And I'm so relieved, actually, that's not the case, that what I found is this: there's this beautiful dance happening between being fully immersed in my small self, as Douglas would probably call it, and then finding the way back home to the big one, which is untouched by all of it. But to have this movement back and forth, like a dance, and the dance goes quicker. I'm less lost over the years in all types of emotions and preferences and dislikes and all of it, to find the way home so quickly, quicker and quicker and quicker. I think that's the benefits for me from the Headless Way, and saying goodbye to the fantasy.
Thank you, Hank. I find and Lauren, yes.
I find that the back and forth is part of this, almost intrinsic to seeing. So whatever is going on, say I'm, like Judy was talking about, say I'm having an argument with someone or having some kind of feeling. If I remember to look, then I look. Then I notice if there's any shift, if there's any difference. And whatever I notice is what I see.
Thank you, Hank. Lorraine?
So what I want to say is that in my case, at the beginning, I felt that there was something to do, and I think it's a classical thing to think that there is something to do, something that we have to do. But what I discover is that there is really nothing to do, because the space is only in, you have to comment dire, se détendre.
To rest
in that, and I think the way is to see that there is nothing to do really. It's always here, and it's not a problem if sometimes you are not, your attention is not on this space, because this space is the base of what you are. So it's always here. No, it's not really a problem.
Yes, I agree with Lauren. I mean, when I discovered, in fact, that it was my true nature, we don't really need to create something, you know, it's always there, it's always open, but every time look at it. So the question is how to come back. And thanks to Douglas' experiment, it's now simple to come back. That's the key, you know, I think the key of this way. It's very simple to come back. It's like, you know, the way, you know, the way is looking here. You have to return your attention back. It's very simple. and you don't need to go in a dojo for doing that. You don't need a place, a special place. It's always there, in fact.
And maybe the way is to understand that. Maybe to practice is to understand that slowly.
Thank you.
I'd also agree that this is always here, and the attention maybe get drawn off of it, but it's always there. It's who this is expressing as at the core. And so it can't go anywhere. It's not going anywhere. Where would it go?
It occurs to me, just to jump in and just say an obvious thing, is that in our view, in my view, everyone gets this. What am I talking about? Look for your head. You can't see your head. Instead, you see the world. That's it. But it's a nonverbal experience. So I'm convinced we've all got it. It's not a feeling. It's not a thought. It's so simple and available. But we all express it differently. And there isn't a right way of expressing it. And your way, you know, people who are in the audience, so to speak, is obviously as valid as ours. We're just friends here sharing our personal responses to this experience, which is available to everyone. Yeah, you can't get it wrong, and you can't do it better or worse. Yeah. All right, Amir and Jade, something else jump out there?
There's several questions that have come through that are quite similar in different ways, so I'll just read out a few, and then people can respond in the way they see fit. One from Max, question to the panel: does anyone practice being headless daily in some sort of prolonged, for example, 30-minute formal meditation? And there's several people asking quite similar ones, that they did a Vipassana retreat, but they're interested in replacing their regular practice with headless experiments, but they haven't yet got it. Do they have any suggestions? Someone else who has a long-term practice for 30 to 40 minutes, they'd like to fill that time with headlessness instead of what they used to do, and want some tips. Someone, Eden, asking, how do I get into actual practice on being headless? The intro seems too general, hoping to get steps or links to actual practice workshops. And there's a few other questions on, like, technically how to start. So maybe there's a way of combining answers to those. How is headlessness way different from meditation way? So that's kind of a broad summary of a group of questions.
Marvelous. And do remember, Jade and Amir, you know, if you feel like responding, I know you're on the job there, but, you know. So does that subject appeal to someone? Ah, Becky.
Yeah, so there are actually many things I do on a daily basis. And it doesn't take the same. I used to, prior to Headless Way, I used to sit and meditate for hours. And this doesn't take the same form for me. The first thing I do is when I walk the dogs, I always remember to be face to no face to people. So as someone's approaching me or coming in the direction that I'm in, I'll say it to myself, face to no face. I won't point. I live in New York City, I won't do that. But I will say it to myself. And sometimes I will have walked for a while, oh, I forgot to go face to no face. And I'll, oh, yep. And that's all happening in my imagination. I'm not pointing, but I'm remembering. And then it's just the most natural thing in the world at that point. There's no head there, so all of this is happening in me, all of this. And it just comes up naturally. And then at some point during this walk, which my dogs are chihuahuas, it takes a whole block, I'll have a conversation with somebody. And then sometimes I'll remember the nature of being face to no face during the conversation. Or sometimes I'll remember afterwards that I forgot. And notice that the conversation worked anyway. There was space. One of the other things I do is Richard has this book out, Everyday Seeing, which is a quote a day by Douglas Harding. And I leave that book open all day. So I will read that quote several times in a day. That's another thing I do. And during the process of, I think of it as downloading headlessness. Like, you know, like at first I would forget about being headless. And for me, the most visceral difference between headlessness and thinking I was a head, that the mind was everything, was that the state of headlessness is so spacious. And feeling like you have a head and your thoughts predominate, for me, it was very constricting. So that's like a cue to me. If I'm feeling that constriction, I forgot that I'm space for the world. And it's as easy as this, check. And there was like one period when I kept checking. Like, did I lose the headlessness? No, it's still, like it didn't feel real and I had to keep doing that.
Wonderful, thank you, Becky. Amarinato.
So I dedicated a huge part of my life to Vipassana meditation and I've done many, many retreats and I can sort of sympathize with the grief that one has to go through after you've dedicated so much time to a practice, which actually you can sort of do immediately now. You know, you point here, that's it, it's finished. So there's such a big investment, you know, and when you practice that type of meditation, your attention is being trained in a particular way. So it's sort of like you're focusing on the body or an object. And here that there is no object, it's just pure subjectivity, you know, it's just this is it. So moving from a sort of Vipassana practice, how might you do that? One of the ways I found really helpful is to open your eyes. Because usually we're asked to close our eyes and bring attention inwards. And then usually that can bring you to your physical sensations. And then that really brings you with a sense of a concrete sort of an identity. And if you practice a lot of Vipassana, it'll bring you into the observer mind. Yeah, well, and the observer mind is just another construct of the mind. It's just another part of your ego. It's fancy, but it's still doing something. So the ability to sort of let that go as well is another part of that grieving process. That all that time that you spent cultivating something that's observing something else, that one has to be relinquished, has to be put aside. And the way that you may want to use your mindfulness practice is your mindfulness practice becomes actually a bit like what Becky was saying, actually just remembering who you are. It's just a basic practice of saying, oh yeah, can I see my face? No, I can't. You know, a lot of people that seem to be asking questions, you know, about the, are there sort of like multiple steps or things, but this, here it is, isn't it? I mean, if I just look now, I can't see my face, you know, and it seems like me and Karen are looking out the same space. And yet when I turn to her, of course, I can see Karen. But, you know, and then I can think, oh, well, I want a body sweep, you know, if you've done Goenka practice, you know. So then the mind goes into, oh, I want to sweep through my body because it gives nice, pleasant sensations. But it's still got nothing to do with what's going on here. So it's just a sense of also having to let go of a formal practice.
Mm.
You know? It's great to use it. They're all really good to look after the body and stay healthy and keep in check, and even dealing with stress and anxiety, all those practices can be really helpful, but they don't liberate the mind. They build upon it. So you see, you have to also have an inquiry into that. It's just a little suggestion.
Thank you. Christine.
So there was an earlier question about children. And I just feel like I can answer this one because I have Jade, who's 19 years old. And the first retreat that I ever took her to, she was 16, because what happened was I wasn't even going to bring her to the headless retreat, but my babysitting situation fell through, and then she ended up coming along just kind of as a happenstance. And I never forced seeing upon her. I never pushed it, because I really, really do think that children, they can be exposed to it, but I don't think it's good to like force something on them. And I really think that because I let her develop in her own way and come to it on her own, like she still doesn't come to weekly Zoom meetings, and I don't mind, you know, it's entirely her choice. So do you want to talk about your art, Jade, and what you do and stuff like that?
Yeah, so last semester in my college classes, I had taken a ceramics course. And our ceramics teacher, he's really passionate about like climate change, and like kind of like helping the environment in like small ways that we can as like each individual people. And then like as a whole too, like our class, like he had all of us group into little teams and come up with like an imaginary like kind of machine, I guess, to like help with the climate and change something so that we can like make the earth a better place. And another team, they came up with the idea our team was like more like we created like kind of like bio urns. So when you pass away, you can get cremated and then be planted as a tree, sort of like the idea that they already have out there. But we were thinking more like a grove of trees, or like a specific area, like instead of a cemetery where they just have like coffins, they would have like maybe like trees instead, like a sacred forest kind of thing. So I thought that was a really cool idea. And so we made our project based on that. But the other team I was really interested in, I took a picture of it. They focus more on the idea of like the human like capabilities. So this, if you can see it, they built these little masks. So it's like a sculpture that they were thinking of setting up in the public. And that you would actually sit down, stare into the mask, look at the other person. Because I guess the eyes are like the view into the soul. And so if you're looking at someone else's eyes, like you can really like feel them and like be them. And so that was super interesting, because like instead of like working on like the environment, we were then working on ourselves to change and better ourselves.
So I kind of, when she showed me that picture, I was like, oh, that's so headless. There's these people with these masks. And to me, it's like recognizing that we are our bodies, and we're not, we just have bodies, you know, we are, okay, let me rephrase that. who we really are is this open, spacious awareness that is the capacity for the world. We're the emptiness that is open for everything. So we're empty and full. So we're emptiness and fullness. And I thought that the two masks with the faces looking through the two masks was really depicting that two-way seeing that we have bodies and we are not bodies. And I thought it was a beautiful representation of that, where while recognizing that there is no separation between the two.
Mm. Yeah, it's face and no face as well, yeah.
Yes. And then do you feel like it was helpful, Jade, that I didn't push this on you? Like, do you want to just speak to that for the questions?
Yes, it's good. It's like you can like kind of like understand your own kind of ways of thinking about it. Like, it's good to have like that kind of information at first, so you know that there's like people out there in a community that like understands these kinds of things. But I would definitely say, like, if you have kids that you want to introduce it to, like, just give them the ideas and resources, or then, oh, you should do this, you know, it's like, they'll be like, oh, I don't know about that one.
And the time that I've introduced it to my 13-year-old son, he was like, yeah, I know. I already knew that. Like, it was no big deal. He already knew that. He was like, yeah, like, big deal. It was very like, he just thought nothing of it. I think it's only when we've suffered and gone through things as adults that we need this resource. Sometimes kids are like, so what?
Thank you. Thank you. I saw a question just out the corner of my eye about I don't see it. Someone saying I don't see it. And I think it's worth just underlining that briefly, that if what are we talking about? Can you see your own face now? You can't. Instead, you see the world, I'm sure. That's it. It's not feeling. It's not understanding. Feeling and understanding are important, how you respond to it. But what often puts people off or makes them think they haven't got it is because they don't feel anything. Well, there's nothing to feel here. But the question is it true? And do you want to live from the truth? I suppose is one question there anyway. So anything anyone wants to say, or Amir and Jade, another question? Please,
you've got to. Just to say something about somebody has commented, I can see my face, I can see my nose, my eyebrow, my upper lips, my tongue, and my upper cheek.
Oh no, it's all gone wrong. Would someone like to respond to that?
Yes, of course I can see a sort of nose, in fact, but it's really a shadow, you know, going from the below to the height, you know. It's not really something solid. And in fact, the important question for me is to realize that nobody is seeing here. There is no observer, no seer. Can you see the seer? In fact, above your shoulder, there is nobody. No, there is just a space for the world and for everything. So of course you can see a little shadow here. You can maybe see your eyebrows. But there is no observer. You know, it's very strange. I mean, it's a mystery. Nobody is looking. Nobody is thinking. Nobody is hearing. But there is vision. There is hearing, and that's a mystery. I can't understand it. But truly, I see it. Yes.
I want to say that what I used to say is that there is two sides. There is a one side with the face. This is the l'envers, the
outside.
Yes, thank you. And the other side is the center side. So it's true in a certain way that there is a face, but it's not on the center side, on the
outside. L'envers.
Yes.
Hank and then Judy, yeah.
I know when I look out at the screen here, you can't see it, the attendees, but the people here, there's about 13 faces, 12 or 13 faces.
I think they can see everyone, yeah.
Okay, great. Well, they are all clearly faces. I have no doubt that they are faces. They're whatever the description of faces are, that's what they are. When I look here, whatever it is I see, maybe I see an eyebrow, maybe I see an upper lip, maybe I see a nose or something, but whatever it is that's here, when I direct my attention here, it's not like what's there. That much is obvious.
What is it like there then, Hank, for you?
Then I can describe it and I can say, it's like one big window, one big transparent window that I'm looking out of. Or it's like one boundless space. All sorts of ways of describing it, and each of us probably have a different way of describing it. But whatever it is, it's not what I see there.
Yes, sir. Judy. Judy and then John.
Douglas had a marvelously dramatic way of talking about this, I always thought. And since I was a biology teacher, it appealed to me a great deal. When we look at someone else's face, even if they're our nearest and dearest, if we are really, really honest, we know that that face is made of flesh and blood and bone and gristle and bodily fluids. And that if we were to go and examine that head over there really, really carefully, that's exactly what we would find. And Douglas used to say, we would find a meatball. Now, are you looking out of a meatball at this moment? And if you say yes, well, I guess I've got to accept that that's what it's like. It's where you are is all gooey and liquid, dark, and not probably very pleasant. Whereas in my experience, and I think in everyone else's experience, if they're prepared to be to not think but to look, it is, as Hank just said, a clear window, a clarity in which the world is suspended. All the things in the world are suspended in this clarity, which has no boundaries, no edges, and which is not something. It's certainly not a meatball.
On having no meatball.
Right.
John.
Yes, Hank, Shakespeare had a go at describing it. He called it our glassy essence. It's not a bad effort, really. And if you go on the Headless Way website, there's an experiment to address every single one of the objections that one might have to this insight that here I'm openness rather than a body, a thing, okay? And there are, 15, 20 experiments. If you click on the link to the experiments, you'll find them all there. And if you can find someone to do them with, that's brilliant, okay? But, they are the bedrock of all our experiences, actually doing the experiments. Commend them.
Yes, Karen.
It's so, every time I'm just blown away, I'm so super astonished that actually here is nothing. When I put my hands behind my head, they disappear in, I don't know what, but they're really gone. And all the qualities that I can give out to things and the world and Amma and, whatever, nothing I can describe this. I mean, I can say, it's an open window, somebody said, it's glossy essences, but these words are just an attempt to describe something indescribable, and it's astonishing, and it's such a relief to admit there's nothing here. This whole person that I always in the outside world admit, oh yes, that's me, here she doesn't exist. It's not even a she. There's not even existing. It blows you away, does it? And it's such freedom. Well, freedom, another word. Such a relief. She's thank not you. Here.
Thank you. Lorraine?
Yes, what I want to say that what is important to see is that identificate to a face is a construction. And it's not given by experience, because when we were very, very young, we didn't identify. with this space. And at this, on the same time, we can see that the body, when you close the eyes and when you put your attention on the body sensation, you can see that there is no form to the body sensation. There is a lot of things that are very, we can be astonished by this thing, because we used to think a lot of, we have a lot of idea about ourselves, but if we confront the experiments, if we experiment the real things, we see that we enter in a world who is very different, because the body sensations are wide open. They have no form. They take all the place in the consciousness. And, I think that to answer to that question, you have to experiment.
Very good. Jade and Amir, did you see other things there? And you, do you and Jade have any things you want to share about living the headless life?
I've been quite busy. There's a surprising number of questions and comments coming in, so I'm quite busy in like reception mode. All I can say is back here, there's still nothing happening. But out here, there's two screens and lots of questions and comments and technical things going on.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought I'd share one other thing that's come up from quite a few people who are maybe, this is their first exposure to headlessness, or they're feeling like they're not getting it, or they're a beginner and want more guidance. So again, I don't know if you wanted to point them in, and I think a few people have been doing that in the comment section, either point people to resources where they can start with this, or do an experiment for people who are very, very new to this. Okay. And then there are other questions coming from people who have obviously done this a little bit, or done it for a while.
I think, first of all, there are lots of resources, like John here does a Monday evening workshop online that is free. So that is one way forward, where you can go through the experiments. And if you need information about that, you just go to the headless.org website, and on the homepage, you'll see in the news section information about those weekly workshops. Of course, there's a lot on the website. And we have regular Zoom meetings, 5, 6, 7 a week, which are free. And just contact me through the website. But we can all do this. Just one very simple experiment, which is directing your attention. And you need to use your finger. So, no one's watching. Point at somebody on the screen, at their face, you see. You're directing your attention. So this is extremely simple. You're directing your attention out, and you can see their face, and they've got a background and the colors and shapes and movement. Now, you turn your finger around, and probably don't look at the screen now, just look at your finger and point back at where others see your face. What do you see? I can say that for me, I don't see a face, I don't see a background, just an open space. It's a nonverbal experience, so I'm sure you've got it. You'll describe it in your own way. And that's what we're talking about. Shock horror.
We have a question here. Sorry, did you want to speak, Amber?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, this turning the finger back here, this is our culture, everything is always pushing us outwards. And so this, shift our attention around is also sort of like, it's anti-culture, because it all marketing, advertising, newspaper, the way the coronavirus is being spread is all about bringing your attention outwards. And so to reorientate yourself, and sometimes for the new, for those that are new to it and they struggle with it, it takes some time to keep shifting that attention, even though it's so simple, to keep shifting oneself back. And so it's not like in sort of classical mindfulness, you can sort of beat yourself up about trying to, I've got to get it right. But the thing is just to keep trying and experimenting and seeing, is what is actually here right now because the world is always put, our attention is always outward, you know, and so much of our lives is always focused outwards. And just to keep reminding ourselves, just what here, you know, that's it.
Yes, Jose.
Yes, the experiment we just did for me is a key of this teaching for me, because it's, you know, we have to turn back our attention here, 180 degrees back to the source. And Amar Anato is right, we always look this direction and we forget to look back here to the source. And it's so simple. I remember once in Paris, Douglas came for a workshop, and with a lot of people, maybe 150. And he just began in saying that, you know, it's so simple that it is embarrassing to be all together here for this workshop, because it's so simple. So we think maybe because we have read some books that it's difficult to see our true nature, but nothing is more simple, and it's for everybody. You don't need to be a monk, you don't need to be a philosopher, you don't need to be somebody special, you don't need to have powers. I mean, it's so simple. Just look above your shoulder and you will find space, an open space, awakening space, and everything is coming in it, and so you got it. Everybody got it.
Yes, yes. Becky and Judy.
I found it helpful to reflect on how we came to learn that we have a head in the first place. That, you know, like, I didn't realize this when it was happening, that I was becoming accustomed to my true nature, but to see myself with a face, like I'm looking at myself in the screen now, and to believe that that's who I am, I had to learn that. It didn't just happen. And I have no memory of it, but I worked really hard at learning that. And I'm laughing because, Richard, the first time you described this, it made me laugh so much that, you know, somebody taught you that reflection in the mirror, and then you had to turn it around and somehow juxtapose it up on your shoulders. And then you came to believe that's who you were. But when we go like this, the question is, who do I see that I am? Not who do all of you see that I am? Not who have I been told that I am? But what do I see? And then the irony is, we're taught not to point. What you might discover if you point, it's not polite to point.
You're being impolitely aware. Judy, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I did. Just think back how many years it took you to learn to put your face on. You know, from when you were a tiny baby, didn't have one, and then you learned about the mirror, and then you learned that person was you in the mirror and all that stuff. And when you were at school, people told you what you were like and who you are and how you should behave. And all the way in your adolescence, when you had to make your way with others of your same age, and you had to be a person, you had to be somebody. And then you're an adult, and you have to be somebody to get a job. And we invest so much in our personhood, and we have to as human beings, otherwise we don't function. But we forget that what's behind this is this timeless clarity, which is none of those things. And when I first met Douglas, I kept thinking, oh, I haven't got it. It's got to be something more than this. It can't be just this. I haven't got it. And I would have to go back and talk some more, do some more experiments, and come back to the simplicity of this. And it's very difficult to be simple enough just to accept that this is how I am. And it's taken many years of deconditioning, you know, like when you've been a deep sea diver and you come back up again, you've got to spend, you've got to get rid of all those bubbles of nitrogen in the bloodstream. And I think it's rather similar. They bubble away, and this, which is so natural, is how we are always. But the familiarity helps. So I don't think we should. I think we should be wary of thinking, oh, it's got to be something that I haven't got yet.
Mm.
And the other thing, of course, is we're generally, as human beings, the idea of self-improvement is pretty much ingrained, and we all have the feeling it's got to make me a nicer person, or whatever it is that we think is wrong with us. But actually, you kind of come back to accept your humanness just as it is, and then it changes bit by bit.
Well, one of my reflections on presenting in these webinars is we're just ordinary people. We're not no one special, but we've all got it. And everyone, no one can see their own face. And I hope that we can encourage all of you listening and watching that you've got it. You can't see your face, and something like that. Yes, Christine.
So, having been involved in this, I think I said since 2004, but I think it was more like 2014, I was thinking about, that didn't make sense. But so just over these last 6 or 7 years, I've struggled between the doing and the non-doing. And that is even a struggle with me overcoming my cancer diagnosis. There's a kind of this fine balance that I need to find between pushing and doing some exercises and mobility things for my arm, because I had lymph nodes removed, and making it all swollen and making it worse and going backwards. There's a fine line between doing and not doing, because I've also found that to be true in seeing. And when I do nothing and just allow this to kind of be happening, because you know, we're always seeing all the time, then sometimes I just forget, and I could be teaching in my classroom and be kind of like not aware of my true face, like the face before I was born, as they say in Zen. But then when I do attend the weekly Zoom meetings and I do certain practices, it helps me remember. And then when I'm teaching at the front of my classroom, I'm like, oh yeah, I am these 30 students, and I have more compassion, and I realize that we're all connected, and I'm a kinder, more tuned in teacher, because there's just less separation between my students and myself. And I'm just kind of in the flow more, especially when I'm, you know, it doesn't mean that I have to be aware of my true face 24/7, but I think that there's this whole Sam Harris, small glimpses many times, on Locke Kelly. There's different teachers who point you to this, but at the same time, it's so simple. And it's like being a little avatar in a video game. When I'm walking and I see these arms, when I'm walking and I see the trees flowing in, and I'm going past a fence, and the fence posts are coming into this space, this aware space. It's a reminder of who I really, really am, that I'm not this little avatar body, that I'm the awareness that's so spacious and capacious and is open for what's happening. I'm like the unscreen. It's so easy to describe what it's not versus what it is. I'm the mystery that cannot be named. Mm-hmm. And so when you're driving, it's easy to be driving and just make your peripheral vision really wide and just notice that you're not going anywhere as awareness. The scene is moving into you. And just continuing to do those little practices, because yes, my fiance has seen this, has seen his headless nature, but he doesn't do anything about it. It doesn't mean much to him. But whereas I kind of find that balance between doing and not doing, and just kind of, it's like, can I do practices? Can I do these exercises like this and this, or twirling, or doing all the things that are recommended on the headless.org website? There's all these pointers that can keep bringing it back and bringing it back and bringing it back, versus, you know, do I just do nothing because I already am everything? I did 20 years of meditation. I did buy 10,000 books and read 10,000 books and did searching. And it was like so exhausting and expensive. And it's like, oh, it was this easy all along. All I had to do was go, come home to myself. I just came home to myself and go, oh, I'm home. So.
Welcome home. Lorraine?
Thank you, Christine. I really like what you just said. And I like this notion of flow. I think it's very important. And at the beginning, maybe I thought that identification was a problem. But there is no problem. You have to be one with life, and the way to be one with life is just to see here. And when you see here, there is no separation between what is inside, what is it's really the, because we did this at 10 minutes ago, but we can add this. It's there is two directions, and these two directions are one. There is no obstacle.
Obstacle, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, yeah, my English is terrible, but
it's very good, Lauren. Very good.
Charming accent, I'm sure.
Yes. Karen.
Yeah, I agree. It's this utter simplicity, this coming home, this just what I am is actually this moment. Everything happening here, the sounds, the vision, and that's it. Period. That's it. You can think about it for a long time, but it won't bring you here.
Okay, Jane, Amir, any other questions to jump out for you there?
Yeah, we had one quite a while back. Do you ever feel a burning sense need to tell others about this, but are afraid that they will think you're crazy?
Can you answer that one, Jade?
I tell them whether they think I'm crazy or not. Just keep going. And I guess when explaining to people who don't realize they're headless, I didn't get it at first. I was like, I'm pointing at my finger. I don't see this nothing that everyone's speaking about. But I guess practicing it daily or just integrating it into my daily life has kind of made me realize that I have no head, even though it was always there anyway. Yeah.
Sequoia and then Lorraine. Sequoia.
Yeah. There's no desire here to share with others. It just doesn't come up. Living from it, I think, is the biggest teacher. Expressing it in your interactions with others. And that is how this expresses and teaches those around you.
Thank you, Lorraine.
Yes, I want to say that maybe if you begin with the closed eyes, maybe it's easier for people who really don't know about meditation, because it's usual on the... But the closed eye, the headless closed eye is different, because there is a question about your identity. So there is a link to the headless, with the open eye. I think if you want to share that with people who really don't know, maybe you can start with the exercise closed eyes.
Ready for another question?
Yep.
What about the feeling of shame in this process? And other people have mentioned other emotions. Shame seems to make me a thing again, puts me back into this person. What is your experience?
I think I'll go and then Emma. I think that my own discovery is that, in truth, no feeling gets in the way of seeing my no face. Now, this doesn't make the feeling go away, certainly not immediately. So I feel shame, I feel sadness or fear or anxiety. But the question is, I suppose, at least I'm asking, is not how to get rid of that feeling, but who am I? Am I a thing here, feeling shamed, or am I space for that feeling? And I find when I look now that my feelings are arising in the space along with what's going on in the screen, and here I'm empty for it. And I think that it's for each of us to see whether these feelings really do get in the way of seeing who we are. I find they don't. Yeah. Don't make them go away. Straight away, but yeah, Emma.
Yeah, I guess like with those very strong emotions, is to see whether, you know, if they keep repeating even within the space, and then sometimes they for me personally, and because I also work as a coach, that sometimes you need other tools. Yeah, although they can come into the big space, that sometimes they require another look at your identity, and to see maybe there's so I would say something developmentally that needs to be explored, and find some way of working with that. So in meditation, it's like, you know, sometimes you can have a physical pain just because you sat wrong, or you can have a physical pain because actually there's something wrong with your leg. And if there's something wrong with your leg, sometimes you need a bit of extra support, and you know, to work out where that is. And that's my personal experience of it.
Yeah.
I'll just add a variation to this question. So, you know, for one person, shame takes them out. For another person, a headache. You know, it's very hard to feel headless when there's a headache, as another example of something that seems to change.
Well, I get headaches, migraines, and I know what you mean. They're awful. But the, you know, if you, as I said earlier, I think this is an opportunity in that moment to practice attention and see whether the headache really does cover over the space. It doesn't. It does not make the headache go away. But this is for exploring, and I find life gets more and more challenging, whether it's headaches or, you know, what's happening in the world at the moment. Life does not get easier in my experience, but it calls on me in this new challenging situation, whether it's a headache or shame or coronavirus, to step up and attend to who I am. Just sit face to no face, it's coronavirus to no coronavirus, it's headache, it's shame to none. This is a personal thing, but it is, what other response are you going to have, really? You know, anyway, that's my response. The opportunity in this situation right now, in the webinar, is to be aware of my true nature, yeah.
What comes up for me is that through headlessness over the years, there's less and less desire to change what's coming up, regardless of what it is. There's less of a felt need to make it be different than what it is, and to honor what's showing up instead of trying to get rid of it or to alter it in any way.
Thank you. Jose?
Yes, we all have difficulties in life, difficulties with our bodies, with our relationships, with our feelings. But these difficulties are opportunities to look to who has these difficulties. I remember Douglas said the difficulties of the little one are the opportunities of the big one. The big one is this clear emptiness. I mean, if we have no problem in our life, we will never look back to the source. We will stay in the little one. We will stay in the ego. So thanks to our difficulties, you know, because they push us to look here to the source, to find peace and relief. I think. Well, in my life, it was the difficulties of my life which pushed me to find the true answer. And the true answer is our true nature.
Mm. Becky?
Just to add to this conversation, I find that sometimes the way this plays out for me is after having been in a situation that was challenging, I'll think to myself, oh, that would have gone better if I had remembered headlessness. You know, like the realization that I wasn't making space for what was going on. I wanted the negativity to be gone because I want to be happy all the time.
Something that's been really powerful here is the statement, know the truth and the truth shall set you free. And this is the truth. And it doesn't say know the truth and do all kinds of stuff and clear up your conditioning. It says know the truth and the truth shall set you free. This knowing is what sets freedom in motion.
Yeah. We've got about 7 minutes left.
There's still lots of great questions that have come through that we probably won't have time to get to. So maybe it's a good time for a practical one. Before ending, can any of the panelists holding local gatherings please tell us where and when? So I think Zoom calls have been mentioned a lot, but maybe people are spread out around the world here. Or how to get on email lists for alerts and gatherings.
Jose and Lorraine, do you want to say what you do in Paris?
Yes, but it is in French. So we are giving workshop in our apartment twice a month, and I'm traveling all around France and Belgium and Switzerland to give workshop, but in French. So I don't know if our friend here can understand French.
Yeah.
And in summer we do one week
workshop. Yes.
Yeah.
With Catherine, and yes, Catherine
Arnold. Down in the south somewhere, isn't it?
Yes, in the south of France. Yeah. Usually there's English friends.
Yes.
You're welcome. Huh?
And how do people find out more about this? Sorry if you mentioned it, but I didn't catch. You have a website or a...
Yeah, Vivre Sans Tête, is it? Or what's your website?
Oh, yes, there is a French website. Vivre Sans Tête, yes, which is translation of on having no head. Yes, and you can find a lot of video with Douglas in English, of course, and Catherine and Richard, and a lot of articles, but in French. Yeah. Hello. Yes, I'm coming in May near Geneva. Yes, if the coronavirus allow us to travel, I will be there in May.
Karen. In
Holland, yes, I'm in Holland. Unfortunately, next weekend, I was going to have a workshop, which can't happen. The center closed down, and we just heard before this webinar was starting that schools are closing down and everything is closing down. So the next one, hopefully happening, will be in Holland in Lelystad, which is about the center of Holland, on Sunday, June 14th. And my website is headlesscafe.info. But also I'm on the big website on their workshops worldwide.
And if you go to our website and go to workshops, you'll see lots of information there. And we have 7 or 8 regular free online Zoom meetings. And to get more information about that, email me. If you just go to the website, you will find my address, their contact. And we don't just put it out for everyone. We want people who are interested, who've done some experiments, but you're very welcome if you're interested to drop in and join us there. And we have an American gathering in August and the English one in July. And John does the Monday evening online workshop. So there's lots on offer for you. So, and we, what we're interested in is making friends. Not students, not clients, but friends who are sharing this, that this is inspiring to, and it's inspiring to meet you and to hear from you, which we can't do very well in this format. But Judy, you've got your hand up there.
There might be somebody who's within reach of South Wales, and I run over the winter, I run fortnightly. A course is called Universe Explorer, but also, if there are enough people who are interested, a monthly just get together for sharing and talking and generally being with each other. This is going to be more difficult in the next few months, obviously, but it will start again, hopefully, in the summer, autumn.
And how do people find out about that one, Judy?
Well, that's a good question, because I haven't done anything.
Put it on the website.
Yeah, Richard, I'll do that. I'll give Richard the details.
And also, I'm doing things at the Psychedelic Society, which Amir and Jade are involved with. Do you want to say anything about that, Amir?
Yeah, so obviously a lot of our events are not as secure in terms of because of the coronavirus, but generally speaking, we organize a lot of events, many of which are on these topics, and several recently, and we hope to have many more with Richard, courses and workshops and little gatherings, and that's in East London. When it looks like we can very confidently host more events without fear of them being cancelled, then we hope to put them together in other parts of London as well, but for now they're in East London. And I posted the website for that in the chat, psychedelicsociety.org.uk.
Thank you. This is the Universe Explorer model, which is now available. You can order it via the website. So it just shows you all your layers. So it's a wonderful thing. So that's a little bit of promotion there. All right, well, we're just about the end of it. Just thank you, all the panelists, so much. It's just been a wild, lovely to be with you. Yeah. And thank you for all of you who have turned up and asked wonderful questions and just supported us and enjoyed being the space together, which is one. So, you know, we're all in this together, and we're here to celebrate and share this very simple, direct way home to our true nature. And we're all learning as we go along here. Yeah. Anyone want to say a final thing before we finish here? Silence is gone.
I just like to say thank you to everyone, and it's been a wonderful opportunity to meet with all the panelists. I learned so much and grow so much from everybody's experience of their true nature. And thank you all.
Well, you speak for us all, Les, of course.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, everybody, and we will close this.